good reason I could never be a vampire is all the murdering. Another good reason is because I could never give up coffee. Especially now that I've switched to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this phenomenal coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a Coffee of the Month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. Life is short for us mortals, so why should we spend our brief lives drinking mediocre coffee? Make the switch today by plugging yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I want to suck your blood and also your coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy week 3 in Scary Movie Month, friends, and merci beaucoup for spending some time with the next 168 Project, the weekly classic films podcast. Almost weekly. We were off last week. Our years-long commitment to review the 123 pictures on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists ended in December 2013. Ever since, we just talk about whatever we want. I am the ambiguously gay piano player who dances with corpses, Ryan Ellis. And here's the blonde who wants some more, my wife Bev.
That's me.
She is the Kirsten Dunst of this podcast. And since I just said her name, the coming attractions trivia for Interview with the Vampire Chronicles. Between the Top 100 Project, the Next 100 Project, and Scoring at the Movies also, we've covered 5 Kirsten Dunst movies, and we're going to cover another one in December. Most of them are pretty recently, in fact. What are those 5 previous flicks, and can you guess what the December one will be?
So the 5 are Melancholia, Bring It On, which was you and Chris,
mm-hmm.
Spider-Man 2, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and Wag the Dog.
Mm-hmm. Eternal Sunshine was many years ago, but the other ones were within the last year, literally.
It is amazing.
Wag the Dog was last November. The other ones were all this year.
I don't know if there's that many actors that bear this distinction.
Including her 2 co-stars. I don't know. I didn't actually do the math. I probably should have, but we have not done 5 plus. It'll be 7 by the end of the year. Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt movies, but we will have done that many Kirsten Dunst movies.
Part of it is that in all but 2 of these, she is not the star. She's a supporting player.
That is true. She's barely in Wag the Dog, although it's one of my favorite parts of the movie. These are chips. In Eternal Sunshine, she's got the heart, really. Well, then again, Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet have a lot of heart. But anyway, she's in all of them. Did you say the one we're going to do in a couple months in December?
We're doing Little Women in December.
Mm-hmm. Directed by a woman, starring mostly women, in a movie I have always loved. I haven't seen it in a long time, though. It'll be 25 years old.
She has good taste. I think that's what it reflects. She doesn't need to be the star. Her career has taken more interesting turns.
She was also quite good in Fargo. Season 2, was it? Yes, yeah, season 2.
And I'm currently watching On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is a show that's good. Not great, but she's wonderful in it.
And I think she was promoting that when she was the one saying, I don't know, I feel like I've done the great movies and not been recognized, which is maybe a little bit of boo-boo face, but she's not wrong. And we talked about that way back in January about Melancholia, one of the great performances that was not recognized by the Oscars. And I don't think that many awards bodies, period. Although I think she may have won something at Cannes or one of those festivals, but no Oscar nomination. There probably should have been one for her. And I think she's the best thing in this film, despite the fact she's with 2 of the bigger stars in the world. And certainly one of them was a huge star. The other one was just getting there. Okay, Interview with the Vampire, not with a vampire, by the way, with the vampire, was released by Geffen Pictures. A couple years later, he and Spielberg and Katzenberg started DreamWorks SKG. But anyway, this is Geffen Pictures and Warner Brothers. And that was in November 1994, so this movie is about 25 years old. It was not a monumental hit, considering the stars involved and the popularity of Anne Rice's novel, but it certainly turned a nice profit overall, worldwide. But Bev, since the movie is a quarter of a century old, explain what it's about, please. With the interview, Skinny.
Family. Can't live with them, can't turn them into immortal demons to help ease the existential dread of eternal life. But that doesn't stop Tom Cruise's vampire Lestat from trying. It's the late 18th century in New Orleans, and Brad Pitt's poor little plantation owner, Louis, is seduced by Lestat and turned into a vampire. Then the two of them make a ghoulish family by turning a little girl, Claudia, a young Kirsten Dunst, as we said, into their, quote, daughter. But Louis's lingering humanity and Claudia's permanent childhood tear the threesome apart. Louis and Claudia kill Lestat, or do they? Then they travel to the old world, where they find others of their own kind, but manage to spectacularly spoil that too, leaving Louis all alone, telling his story to a journalist in San Francisco.
We say Louis, but it is Louis, so if I can quote Bridget Fonda in Jackie Brown, Louis, 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 before she gets shot and killed.
But Louis is the French pronunciation, he's French.
I just find that amusing, that it's spelled Louis online, but it's always pronounced Louis. And they're not saying Louis, like they probably should. I like how he says later on, I was Creole after all. Really? You don't sound at all like you've any French blood in you whatsoever.
True. It's no accent at all.
Didn't even try, although we'll get into this soon enough, but Brad Pitt did not want to be in this movie. And in fact, that does fit into my nutshell. So, in a nutshell, I don't want to live forever. It sucks being immortal. Although I do agree with him that I wouldn't want to live forever either.
No, no.
This movie, just like Nosferatu many decades before, and the remake for that matter in 1979, the one that Werner Herzog did, does point out that living forever, you overlook that. And maybe even Dracula for that matter, the book and the movie, points out it would kind of suck to live
a
long time, much more than your 80 or so years you're basically given by your mortality. But still, Brad Pitt's character is so whiny, and apparently Brad Pitt himself did not like making this movie, and that's part of the thing. Maybe it bleeds through into the performance. Okay, so numbers, and then we'll get into the proper conversation. 62% of Rotten Tomatoes critics like this film only, barely a passing grade on the tomato scale, 32 fresh, 20 rotten reviews for an average of 5.9 out of 10. That's some of the worst numbers I've said in quite a while, but 86% of audiences. This is truly an audience movie. It was 11th at the 1994 U.S. box office. Forrest Gump was number 1. The Lion King was number 2. Speed was number 8. And Pulp Fiction was number 10. And we've covered all of those. So go back in the archives and listen to them anytime you want to. We've done a lot of 1994 films. Of course, Shawshank Redemption also from that year. This was the third in Tom Cruise's run of 5 straight flicks that grossed $100 million or more at the box office, which was a very big deal back then. Now, not so much. Not that hard to get to $100 million in the modern era. But back then, that was a huge thing. And he did it 5 years in a row. And many other times in his whole career. The movie was nominated for 2 Oscars, didn't win either of them, for the sets, makes sense, and the music score by Elliot Goldenthal. But it also won a Razzie for Worst Screen Couple, Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, who tied with Sylvester Stallone and Sharon Stone in The Specialist. Now, I know you're not a huge fan, but tell the audience why you don't like this movie that much.
I think it's an objectively bad movie. Either Brad Pitt is phoning it in, yeah, or Louis really is the worst. Right. The pacing would give Ryan Murphy whiplash, and I think it was a mistake to include the Armand,
yep,
theater, the vampire stuff. It's good in the way that it has this sumptuous commitment to all the things that make it a guilty pleasure, though. The attractiveness of the cast, the costumes, the sets, the melodrama. I still enjoy it. I find it a pretty watchable film.
It is.
It truly did change vampires in pop culture from here on out. Of course, a lot of credit goes to Anne Rice and her novels, probably more so than this movie, which was just the thing that made the novels a household name. But the world was never the same for the depiction of vampires after this movie came out.
I'm thinking of 2 words, Twilight.
Or True Blood.
Oh, yeah, that
and
too.
And that's just that scratching show. The surface.
Okay, right. Although, Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Coppola movie from 2 years before, did beat this to the punch quite a bit. That's a better movie. Just as successful, I think.
Yes.
Maybe not financially as successful. Probably should have been. I remember the effects in that were unbelievable. A lot of practical effects in that film. I haven't seen it in a couple of years, but I like that movie quite a bit.
You have to agree, though. They're vastly different movies.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole different theme going on, too. And it's a rare film where Tom Cruise is over the top. I know a lot of critics would say he's not a very good actor. I've read that for a long time. But he generally is believable. In this, he isn't. But that's what the plus is. Whenever he's on screen, the movie's better for it. And that middle section, as beautiful it is to look at, Brad Pitt in Paris, with mostly Kirsten Dunst, although she, of course, dies before that sequence is over. is great to look at. One of the best scenes in the whole movie, at least visually, is when all the vampires converge on that actor who's playing the mortal woman on stage. Incredible visual above. Busby Berkeley kind of thing. You see them just go on and obviously drink her blood dry, but it's supposed to be a show. Looks great. The sequence where Louis is destroying all these vampires, getting revenge, the rare thing, and this movie does a lot of it, where you burn a vampire alive. We've seen so much crucifix action. Not an issue for these guys, apparently. And Pitt even says to the interviewer, crucifixes are fine. You can see her in reflection. But there's some things in the vampire lore that still hold up. Although I don't recall really fire being an issue for them before, but there's a lot of vampires that get burned, especially in Paris when he gets his revenge on them for daring to kill Claudia and Madeline in that well, burned alive by the sun. Also burned, but in a different kind of way.
Lestat survives burning.
And many other things. Slashed in the throat, fed poison blood, dead bodies is like poison to them. And at the end of the movie, he's raring to go again. And you pointed out that Anne Rice has done a lot of sequels, and Lestat's been in, if not all of them, a lot of books.
Accounted. In the Vampire Chronicles, he's been at least a subject, if not the star, of more than half of the books. She includes Louis in stories from here on out, but I don't think he's ever the main character, and certainly not the narrator, ever again.
That's not fair!
He's a downer. He's good in terms of, you want to enter this world, and you need a cipher. You need a newcomer to have to learn about it with the audience. That's what Louis serves. Also, of course, the themes, which are wonderful, actually, part of what makes it so compelling, the theme of him trying to remain human and him trying to maintain his soul, not accepting the price of immortality and just that existential dread that he feels and he struggles with. That's important that you need Louis there to express those themes, because Lestat is never gonna. Full disclosure, I've read some of the books. I think the first 5.
Oh.
There's like 21.
I've read 0.
Yeah, right. I gave up after Memnock the Devil. I started reading the next one and gave up on it. But you learn a lot about Lestat, and he's such a great main character. His charisma is off the charts, and he's the one that you want to spend time with the most. But he's confident, and he feels like he belongs in his place in the
having
world.
Having fun.
He's having fun, yeah.
Tom Cruise visibly seems to be having fun.
And for two actors who agreed to be in a film, you have to give more respect to the actor that dove right in and gave it his all. Mm-hmm. Kirsten Dunst is amazing, and I do agree with you that her performance is the best performance in the film.
Especially since she was 11 when they were
shooting. Yeah, and her character is so interesting. The most tragic figure. A true corrupted innocent who never had a chance. In the book, she's just like 5 or 6 years old, which is, of course, a more extreme and ghoulish thing to imagine. But I'm glad that they went older and cast Dunst, because no 5-year-old could have ever played a 50-year-old stuck in a child's body the way that she does and the way that she pulls it off. It's incredible to watch. It's one of the most interesting concepts in the film. There's lots of things about her book and the film that we've never seen before.
Or had at that point.
Had at that point. Of course, now it's everywhere. It's so tremendously influential. At the time, it was just this amazing thing to behold, and her performance is such a big part of that. Yet, meanwhile, Brad Pitt, who regretted agreeing to be in the film.
Wanted out.
Not as big of a star then. He was a minor
just
star
about,
at that
though.
Point. He was definitely on the cusp, and he was not a big deal. And he had given some great performances that were daring. Like, he had already been in California playing, like, a murderer and a dirtbag.
And Thelma Louise.
Okay, yeah. And
earlier this year, Legends of the Fall
had.
But then he wouldn't have known that. They probably shot that before this. I didn't read if they did, but probably before this movie, because this came out in November, and that was, I think, a summer film. No, actually, that may have been a Christmas film, come to think of it. But anyway, they were the same year, but he wouldn't have known that, well, that's going to make me a star, and I'll do this cool movie, 12 Monkeys, next year, and 7, they'll come out in 95. He didn't know those things were about to happen, probably. He couldn't have had faith in that. But he was a big enough name, I guess, that he probably said, I should get out of this movie, this is not for me. But then David Geffen said, if you try to get out of this, it's going to cost you more than you could ever imagine, so it's not worth it, just finish it through. He had to wear the shitty makeup, took a long time. Cruise's makeup took even longer to get put on, and he had to shoot, they all did, I guess, but Pitt's in most every scene, indoors all the time, dank, he hated that.
At night, also, he hated the night shoots, missed the daylight, I don't know.
Did you read the screenplay?
And, like, also, this is your job, you're getting paid a lot of money, and it's temporary. Can't you just put up with this for a little while? You're not an established star yet. How can you excuse yourself for phoning it in?
It isn't like they cast you in a baseball movie and you think you're going to be in green pastures in the sun for months on end. You knew you were going to be in a movie that was going to be shot indoors. You had to think that or realize that. And you're going to be wearing makeup, and it wasn't going to be fun because it's a vampire movie. Unless it's a vampire comedy, this is pretty much what you should have expected you were going to be in the first place.
We're assuming that he isn't that great in the movie because he didn't care. What is the possibility that he was miscast and this is just something that he can't pull off? He knows how to pick films.
Mm-hmm.
He knows cast in roles that he is going to be amazing at.
He knows how to pick films to produce, too.
Yes, he really does.
His production company has
excellent taste.
Outstanding movies in this decade alone.
Mm-hmm. It's a possibility that this was just a misjudgment on his part. Picked a movie he shouldn't have picked where he isn't going to be able to pull it off.
You know who would have been better in this role? I'm thinking right now.
A lot of people, but...
Yeah. Well, okay, but one name in particular, because he was supposed to be the interviewer and not Christian Slater, but he died outside Johnny Depp's club on drug overdose. I think River Phoenix would have been a great choice for this because I think he's younger than Pitt. He certainly seemed younger than Pitt. Phoenix always seemed boyish.
He had an etherealness about him, too. Yeah, I totally agree.
And even though Pitt, in his 50s now, finally starting to look more of his age, you watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, takes his shirt off and think, how is that guy even 35, yet alone, I think, about 55, give
he's
or 55, take?
He's 55, exactly.
His body, at least. His face looks a little older, just like Cruise now. Finally looks a little older facially than they did a few years ago. Great surgeons, good lighting, I don't know. Just great genetics, I guess, especially with Pitt. But he always seemed more like a man than River Phoenix did at that point. So maybe they rolled him better with somebody who did seem boyish, who didn't really know what they're getting into. Lestat really is guilty of false advertising because he doesn't tell, and he probably should.
He says, I'm going to give you the choice I never had, but he doesn't inform him of what the choices he's
what
making.
What is going to be involved in this, exactly. Because one thing in this movie, and I don't remember ever seeing this in a vampire movie before this, is that the way you become one is not just by being bitten, it's by you drinking their blood. That might be in Dracula, come to think of it, a couple years before. I forget now. I think that's true, actually, with Mina, Winona Ryder's character. Okay. But I don't remember that so much as I do in this movie. This is one of the things I think that stands out, is that when they have their homoerotic moment where they fly up into the air and Cruise might as well be kissing him, but of course he's biting him, and they come back down to Earth. I've drained you to the last possible drop. Say yes, and I'll give you immortality. And really what Louis wants is to die because he misses his wife and daughter, and that's understandable. He's also a slave owner because he owns a plantation in Louisiana, so fuck him.
Yeah, but... seriously. And also, the way that they depict his enslaved workers is you either have the Tandy Newton, who seems to treat him like this beloved master. It's implied that she loves him. She sees him as this paternal and good guy. She's worried about him. And then when he goes to bite her, she gives in to him. It's kind of lustful.
He needs this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then the rest of his workers are these savages performing their voodoo ceremonies, trying to protect themselves. It's not handled delicately, let's put it that way. To begin with the fact that we have this rich boy who owns human beings, that should make him a villain right there, but...
He's a vampire for, what do you say, 200 years?
Yep.
So this is one of two reasonably good questions I have. You may have just answered it, though, by pointing out that they are doing voodoo. I forgot that part. But here's the question. If Louis gets his money from his plantation, no one questions that he's 100-plus years old? Why is our master still alive? He was, I don't know, 25 or 30 when this happened to him. They don't know that he got bit by a vampire. Okay, fine. But it is now the 1800s, the 1900s, and he's just still here, looking pretty young, basically.
You know what the real enemy of vampires is? It's not daylight. It's not stakes of the heart. It's modern record keeping.
It seems like fraud to me.
Well, that's the kind of thing that could fly, I suppose, in the 18th century. But, God, it must be way harder to be a vampire now that they have a missing persons registry to begin with.
Because the end of the movie is set in the modern era. He's going to the movies. He's in a hotel room that's very modern. I think it's supposed to be set in 1994-ish or 93, probably, when they shot the film. It's not like it was from the 50s or 100 years even before that. But anyway, yes, I do like that concept that once Lestat says, you can be like me, but you have to drink my blood, and then Louis does it, which is also true about Claudia, because Louis loses himself for a moment, and he bites Claudia, but it's Lestat who converts her by having her drink his blood. Then the hair goes curly, which she can't cut later on, which is a weird touch also.
And their nails are
my
always
my other
on, I guess
reasonably good question, yeah. Actually, is that one. What's with the your hair will always grow back rule? Her hair changed when she became a vampire. Why does it have to be curly all the time?
So when you become a vampire, you become the most beautiful version of yourself, but you also remain static. You can never change. So if your hair is long, it grows back. Someone slices your face, it heals.
True.
You will always regenerate. That is part of the blessing and the curse of being a vampire. That's why she never grows up.
No, I get all that, but it still seems weird to me that her hair changes. But okay, I guess it's supposed to make her more beautiful. I don't remember what she looked like before she had the curly hair in that brief moment when she's just this girl who's beside her dying mother. Oh. She gets mad later at Louis for doing this, being part of it at least, because it's really Lestat that turns her. But her mother, and I guess her father, had already died of the plague. It wasn't like they killed her mother. They came across these people that were already dead, and they said, hey, there's a girl here.
Oh, yeah, she would be dead. But maybe she's saying, you should have let me die, and then my soul wouldn't be lost,
and I would have
spent the last 40 years here with you jerks, committing murder after murder after murder,
never growing up. Which she likes early on, though. I like that sequence. It's close to good comedy. When you see Lestat and Claudia enjoying the life that Louis never enjoys, and that is killing people and drinking their blood.
She doesn't share any of Louis's moral compunctions, and she has this child's trust in Lestat. She's very open to his influence, and he takes on the role of teacher. Of course, it's very much mother and father. Louis is the mother, Lestat is the father.
Did you notice that early on she does call them mother for Louis and father for Lestat, but later on in France, when it's just the two of them, and Lestat they think is dead, she now is saying, you're my father, something like that.
Oh, I never noticed that she calls him mother. I don't think I picked up on that.
I think in Paris she says, you're my father. And of course this movie has a lot of gay subtext. There's more of it in the book, and it's more obvious in the book, apparently. I think it's just fine in the movie. It's there. Hard to miss it. Would Tom Cruise ever do a movie with gay subtext now? Because this is before he was being outed. Well, out is not fair. I don't know if he is gay. It doesn't even matter. But this is before he had to face lawsuits by people saying, I have video evidence. And the Church of Scientology and Tom Cruise himself fought back hard, and they quashed those lawsuits pretty fast. Maybe they should have. Maybe that person was a complete liar. I don't even know. The point is, would he ever put himself in the position of looking like he could even maybe possibly be gay by playing a gay character? Because that's what Lestat effectively is.
It's sad to say, but in 1994, it was brave of both of them to agree as movie stars to be in a movie where the gay subtext is virtually text. They are, for all intents and purposes, a couple. In the books, it's very clear that vampires do not have sex ever. They have no desire to have sex. It is erased from them the second that they turn into vampires.
Just like
they don't eat or drink
water.
Yeah, that's right. But they do have romantic attachments. And when you remove sex, then the romantic attachments can be between two men, two women. It doesn't matter if you were straight when you were human. When you're a vampire and you take the sex out of the equation, it eliminates all barriers. In one of the books, Lestat is telling his story and talks about how he turned his own mother. And then they basically had a romantic relationship. It wasn't incestuous because there was no sex, but they had that romantic attachment in a way. So that's kind of how, I guess, Anne Rice gets around it. I don't think she's getting around it. I think her writing is very much of the mind of love is love. When you eliminate sex and you eliminate that element, then why shouldn't two men be able to bond in the same way that they would bond with a woman? Vampires are all pansexual without the sex. Panromantic, I guess. Panamorous.
So many movies that Chris and I have covered for Scoring at the Movies, of course, sports movies, but they've been about men almost always. If we really were to analyze it, we probably could say it's there, because anytime two guys get physical with high fives and hugging and patting bums and that kind of thing that they do in baseball and football fields, it's not sexual, and these guys probably don't think of it that way, and of course, guaranteed, in the locker room, they're doing the opposite and being homophobic. But why don't you just kiss each other?
I agree with the theory that when men are really into sports and they can be very physical, it's more like sports give them permission to express physical affection with other men, which is only taboo because of society's massive homophobia and the gay panic. Men are raised to believe it's toxic and it's bad for men. Women don't suffer that. If I want to hug my friend, if I want to touch her hair or her arm or express affection to
people, rarely think anything of it.
Nobody ever second guesses my intentions. Women are allowed to do that, and men, because they're not outwardly allowed to do that, find a way to express those feelings. And when men are single, and you've talked about this before, they can go a very long time without experiencing any touch whatsoever.
Louis must go through that in his centuries of being a vampire, especially once Lestat is quote-unquote dead, and then Claudia is too.
They don't really talk about the 150-plus years that he spends
watching movies.
Yeah, right?
He's the me of this time frame.
The loneliness of his life after Claudia dies and he burns down the theater. he never creates another vampire. He never has company. It must be terrible.
I like the concept, too, that if you turn too many people into vampires, then you have to hang around with them. And obviously Lestat should regret that with Louis because he picked the wrong guy.
Oh, yeah.
You're so boring. At least Claudia for a while enjoyed it. And Louis maybe realizes, well, if I do this, I'm so moral. This other person might not be moral. I can't turn them. Well, turn up my nose at this.
It's funny because...
You were a plantation owner, so fuck you.
Yeah. This is the book that introduces everybody to the Vampire Chronicles and to Anne Rice's world. And so we learn about it from Louis's point of view. But when you've read more of Lestat's stories, to then go back and revisit Interview with a Vampire is to realize that, yeah, this is Louis's story, but to Lestat's life, this is just a blip on the radar. I mean, Lestat lives for hundreds and hundreds of
week.
Years. To him, it's just a blink of the eye.
He was like, so pretty, but
it's like that
so
bad relationship you had in college, and you're like, yeah, things got ugly, let me tell you, but I don't even remember it now. He goes through things that are so much more significant than his relationship with Louis.
So the movie was shot in Louisiana, makes sense. France also makes sense. England and California, because the interview scenes are in San Francisco, especially at the very end on the Golden Gate Bridge with Cruz and Slater in that car. The story starts in 1791, and Louis's 24, so there it is. He was basically a kid still. And he seems to have a death wish, which he sort of gets but doesn't really get. And again, these are all interesting and pretty well done concepts. And as much as the movie lives when Cruz is on screen, it really does take shape and has some heart, more heart, I think, than it has in the rest of the film, when we finally see Claudia, who for an 11-year-old, great actress, I guess we've already established that, Kirsten Dunst. And this is a few years after Anna Paquin had won the Oscar. No, a year after Anna Paquin had won the Oscar for The Piano, who was also outstanding and also complicated and not nice.
Yeah, and then later starred in True Blood.
Anna Paquin did.
Yeah, she's right? The star of True Blood.
Mm-hmm. But Claudia does a lot of things trying to get rid of Lestat. She thinks she's killed him. They dump him in a swamp. He goes through some shit. But then later on, she lights his rotting body on fire when he comes back, and he's playing piano expertly. And then they, meaning both Louis and Claudia, burn down the French Quarter, those fucking assholes.
we burn down, of course, like, the whole city.
Just because they have to get rid of their guy who's tormenting them. And we end up in Paris with a sequence that we said we didn't like that much, because even though Stephen Ray is introduced in that really cool way, the turning set, we just talked about that recently, Nightmare on Elm Street, 2 weeks ago. We took last week off, so our last movie had a turning set. Inception had one. Royal Wedding had one. The Astaire movie from the 50s.
2001 Space Odyssey, famously.
Right, where the camera's attached to the set, it turns, and then as you go with it, it looks like you're the one who's actually turning. I do see the camera shaking a bit as Stephen Ray is walking, quote-unquote, upside down. So that one didn't work quite as well as some of the other ones did. And it's funny, too, because I like the notion that you can live forever, but you don't care about crucifixes, and yeah, you'd have to sleep in a coffin, but reflections are not an issue. The sun is still an issue, and it will kill you, but not instantly, maybe, like we've seen in some other films, where it just touches you, like in From Dusk Till Dawn, and oh my god, it's going to burn me if I don't get out of the sun instantly. But then again, Dracula from 2 years before made the point that it just means your powers are diminished. Doesn't mean you're actually going to die. This one's got more of the killing thing. But then there's not that much supernatural stuff with Louis and Lestat or Claudia until we get to Paris when we see the guy walking up the wall.
And so, mind reading as well.
Right.
Armand and Santiago. No, Santiago's the one that is the expert mind reader because he's the one that puts together that they killed somebody back in New Orleans.
And I guess that's two eyes for one eye because they kill both the girl and the older woman who they think Louis loves. And it's Louis's fault somehow, even though Claudia is the one who actually killed Lestat way back when. But two eyes for that one eye.
Madeline is perfectly innocent.
Mm-hmm. That actress, by the way, has barely been in films. Nothing since 2003. Demisiana Giordano, I think I say her name. But that great image, actually, is one of the things about this movie. The images probably should have been nominated for the cinematography,
they're
too.
Ash corpses.
Yeah, the cinematography in this movie is outstanding.
Yeah, I agree.
And when Louis touches the corpses, they just completely fall apart,
it's
as they should.
It's a beautiful image. I know that has to be special effects. I have no idea how they pulled it off back in 1994, but it's amazing.
And it is a shitty death for Claudia and Madeline to die that way. It probably didn't take too long for that to happen to them, though. So if it has to be that the end of your life is about to happen, probably didn't take days. It probably took a matter of minutes or hours. But then Louis is the one who should be stuck in a coffin for eternity, and they quickly masonry up the wall. Why must I succeed at every attempt at masonry? But then Armand takes sympathy and pulls him right out. It looks like it's immediately.
Armand just wants to keep him from saving Claudia and Madeline. And then as soon as that's a done deal, then he lets him out. Because Armand and Louis have this connection. Armand has answers, and for some reason he's drawn to Louis. I do not understand. They obviously have chemistry that they want to explore, so Armand lets him out.
Antonio Banderas, who the year before was in Philadelphia, who's blatantly playing a gay guy in that movie. In this movie, he might as well be playing a gay guy, because the guys really should be just going ahead and doing it on screen, or at least kissing or something.
They practically kiss. They get real close with each other.
And we talked about the fire sequence that does follow when Louis gets his revenge on all those vampires. But Armand passes his hand through a candle, and yeah, he does flinch. It's in the trailer. I remember that from the trailer very well. So it's not like he likes fire, but it's not immediately lit on fire either, so he obviously survives.
They're not accelerants. They just have to be set on fire.
The sun, though, would have probably done it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And when we get back to the interview scene, and by the way, had it been River Phoenix in that character, so I said before he could have played Louis, but he actually was supposed to have been Malloy. Christian Slater is fine, but it doesn't seem like the role needed to have any kind of star. It's such a small part of the movie. Yeah, I guess he's at the very end, but then he gets quickly offed by Lestat, who's just cackling. Again, cruise over the top, but in a great way.
Well, Lestat's going to turn him. That's just a thing I never needed at the end of the movie, or the book, for that matter, which ends the same way, where the interviewer listens to that whole story and takes the message of, I want to be a vampire too! What?
And then we do actually see Louis do some supernatural stuff, because he does teleport himself, and he also has lightning fast speed and plants Malloy up against the wall. So I guess he does some things. And I guess you could argue that Armand and Santiago and those guys in France developed this power over many years, many centuries possibly, so that's why they can climb up walls upside down and that kind of thing. And Louis doesn't know that yet, because Louis does some of the same things in that interview room, in the hotel room. But then Louis's gone. He gets mad at him. Malloy takes off. Oh, I got a great story here. I can hear it on the tape. And then suddenly up comes Lestat, bites him, and he might turn him. This guy's going to be more fun than Louis was. I'll make him into my new
he's gonna
bitch.
He's going to turn him. He says, I'm going to give you the choice I never had. So he's going
to
turn him.
That's true. I actually didn't say to any of the women. It is fun to watch Cruz and Pitt at dinner. They never eat, of course, in the usual way. But all these women, there's one shot especially where they've obviously, especially Lestat, probably only Lestat at that point actually, has bitten them and they're just laying there. Because they're either literally dead or they're about to be dead, and he's just going ahead and enjoying himself. And I do wish, actually, the vampires in this lore would do human things and mortal things, even if they didn't necessarily enjoy it the same way that we would.
But, like, belch afterwards.
Still eat. Well, maybe that. No, but I meant maybe still eat food, but they don't get much out of it the same kind of way. It'd be like having no taste buds, but you eat because you know you have to. They don't need to, I know. It'd just be kind of fun. And you drink, maybe drink regular water or booze or whatever else. You could say it has no effect, so why bother? I just get to the point where I want to say this part, which I've already said before, the vampire should be fucking. And you said you saw True Blood. I never did, but I know that show was about them having actual sex and also being vampires.
Oh, yeah, they have lots of sex in True Blood.
Because it's such a sexual job, yeah. Unlike in Nosferatu and some other vampire adaptations. Well, the original Dracula movie was like that, actually.
All
it was a pretty sexual.
Vampire stuff is sexual.
For 1931, that Dracula movie by Todd Browning was pretty sexual, I would say.
Sex is always subtext in every vampire story. And it's almost silly just how transparently they equate murder with sex in Interview with the Vampire. When Louis drinks his first human, she seems turned on by it all, even though any normal person would be freaked right out by the way that he's acting. I don't care how into someone I am. If they bite my neck so hard that they draw blood, I want out. And the murders are also seductive. They hire prostitutes.
They won't be missed.
They won't be missed, yeah, sadly. But do you think prostitutes would be like, oh, no, that costs extra. You cannot just bite me. You cannot leave scars on me.
You could argue they're putting a spell on them.
Yeah, because we do see Santiago definitely do that at the Theater du Vampire. So we know that they're capable of it. But there's no real insinuation of that earlier in the film. And I think it's just because thematically, and of course, vampires in general are just so sexual. Even without being sexual, It's deeply seductive.
We have not yet said this guy's name, but he did direct the movie and probably should have gotten at least a co-writing credit with Anne Rice, who did adapt her own novel. But Neil Jordan did direct this, coming off The Crying Game, which won him an Oscar for writing. And then he did The End of the Affair at the end of the decade, 1999, with Julianne Moore.
Why do you think he deserves writing credit for it?
I was reading online that apparently he rewrote this enough that he should have gotten writing credit.
Because plot-wise, it's incredibly close to the book. Well, in fact, I think it's a fault
maybe
how much they stay close to the
book. Because the dialogue is bad. I remember when I saw this movie probably 4 or 5 years ago, much like when I saw Batman Begins that third or fourth time and thought, man, I love this movie, but the dialogue really should have been made better. And I think I saw this not long after that and thought, same problem. Great looking, kind of fun, also kind of dour because of Brad Pitt. But the dialogue is pretty stupid, and maybe that's Anne Rice's fault in this case. Batman Begins is not her fault.
I can't blame Anne Rice for that. I'm not going to defend the books. I really don't remember. I was a teenager, and I was really into them. But I'm not going to sit here and try and say that I had a great taste when I was a teenager. I hate Twilight. I think it's embarrassingly bad, but I can't sit here and tell you that I wouldn't have loved it if I had been 15.
Fair, yeah.
When those books came out, I maybe would have been just as super into those as I was into these Anne Rice novels. And I'm not going to say that the dialogue was better, although dialogue notwithstanding, she did explore some pretty interesting ideas and philosophies. Agreed.
I don't think that Jordan always pulls them off, though, because the movie has a tonal problem.
Oh, yeah.
It should be more fun and campy. When Lestat's on screen, it almost is. It's pretty close to it.
Yeah, it's like he was the only one that knew how campy it had to be.
Be like in the Nosferatu movies and be more dark. And you could say, well, we're doing both, but I don't think he really managed it. And as I've quoted many times, M. Night Shyamalan, he's the one who said it. I think he made a good point. Best thing a director can do is maintain the tone, and it may be one of the hardest things to do in a months-long shoot with big stars and a very high-concept production.
A very beloved and famous book.
But if you don't do that, then you've somewhat failed, and I think Neil Jordan, who I don't love, I looked through his resume just last night, The Crying Game, I thought it was okay, I haven't seen it in a long time. Actually, I think his best movies are probably The End of the Affair. I think Stephen Ray's in that, too. Stephen Ray always worked with them, pretty much, though. He was the star of The Crying Game, for example. And The Good Thief with Nick Nolte. But I look at the rest of his resume and I'm not that impressed by it, including his big red letter movies, The Crying Game and Interview with the Vampire.
It's curious that he would have gotten an Interview with the Vampire after Crying Game, because Crying Game is kind of a gritty movie. It takes place in present day during the Irish Troubles, is that
but
right?
But also gay subtext, not so much subtext, actually, when you know the twist.
Well, I'd say it's queer more than gay, but yeah, the subtext is text.
So anyway, the two stars, Pitt and Cruz, you read online that they battled on this one. I don't know if they really did or not. And if they did, they must have forgiven and forgotten years later, because I've read that they both attended each other's weddings. I'm pretty sure I read that Pitt was at Cruz's wedding to Katie Holmes. And I think I also read somewhere that Cruz was at Pitt's wedding to Angelina Jolie. Now, neither of those weddings worked out, but that's not the point. So if these guys had that much of a battle...
They're bad luck charms.
Maybe they went off and they had sex together, although, anyway, stupid to suggest that. By the way, we rip on Pitt, and I think he's one of the more underrated actors of his modern era, and he is one of the true movie stars. And if you haven't seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Leo's great. Margot Robbie's really good in what is effectively a really small role, but Pitt, that's his movie. He's great in that film.
I don't know. DiCaprio... He really does a lot in that movie.
Well, true, okay, but I think Pitt is outstanding in a way that I was a little bit surprised. It's funnier than a lot of the recent Tarantino movies have been. He's almost always been funny in his films. But Pitt, just the way he says things, just like in Inglourious Basterds, like Kramer on Seinfeld, not funny in the page, funny when delivered by that person doing it that way. So I said before that we've covered a lot of Kirsten Dunst movies, but not that many Cruise and Pitt in comparison, at least. You and I have done Rain Man, Chris and I have done Days of Thunder and Color of Money, so we've done at least four movies in total on this channel, but then Dunst still wins, especially by the end of the year. And Anne Rice did not want him for this movie, and she publicly had a problem with it, but then when she saw the movie, she completely reversed and said, he was outstanding! And kudos to her for actually admitting she was wrong, and I think she was wrong, although I could see why she would have an issue with him getting the role in the first place, but he was also a money actor, so you had to know the movie would be successful. Daniel Day-Lewis apparently had the role, but then I don't know why he dropped out. I guess he did. Jeremy Irons would have been interesting, but maybe the wrong casting for it. Johnny Depp's the one I think would have been the most curious and maybe even interesting, maybe even the best choice for it.
Agreed. He wanted the part quite badly.
Cruz did, yeah. Okay.
He so rarely plays a villain. I can't think of any other part he's done that's quite like this. Maybe the closest would almost be something like Magnolia.
True. But
charismatic.
But in both cases, there's redemption for the characters, because at the end of this, he's not redeemed. He's still definitely a villain of our story. But in a way, they're all villains, because they're killing people just for their own selfish means. He just enjoys it more than the rest of them do.
The movie closes with sympathy for the devil, and it really is asking you to give sympathy to the devil. Louis, who is supposed to be the good one, personally is responsible for the death of a lot of people.
And a lot of rats.
A mass murderer.
So many rats.
And a poodle.
And chickens. Eat chickens. Don't kill them. Anyway, I guess the same thing. We kill chickens, too.
Some people do consider this a movie about vegetarianism.
As Texas Chainsaw Massacre was.
Yeah,
only
yeah.
A few weeks ago for us. And you mentioned Sympathy for the Devil, one of the great songs by the Rolling Stones. And I've been using that phrase a lot lately because I definitely have sympathy for Leatherface especially, but even to some extent, Freddy in our horror movie so far this month.
That's but misplaced.
Even though I enjoy Lestat and Tom Cruise's performance, fuck him still. And the next week's bad guy, also fuck him. So sympathy for the first two villains, not so much for the next two devils.
What about Louis? Do you have sympathy for Louis?
Yeah, but I also got tired of listening to him whine.
It's funny how he is one of the... Well, Claudia is the most sympathetic character of the vampires. Louis should be the one that you sympathize with.
You hear all these inspirational stories about somebody who gets paralyzed and they learn to live their life as well, maybe even better. Chris and I covered Murder Ball a few months ago. Mark Zupan said, I think in the movie itself, that he wouldn't be talking to you in a documentary. He wouldn't be meeting the president at the end of that film, going to the Olympics, the Paralympics, but still, if he hadn't been paralyzed. But even if those things didn't happen for him... or anyone else, most people who get paralyzed, something happens to them, lose an arm, they go blind, they live their life. They try to move on. Obviously, people do kill themselves when something bad happens to them, but a lot of people find a way to move on. Louis has hundreds of years to adapt to the fact that my life has changed. I'm now effectively paralyzed where I was before. But he never, ever seems to find any kind of solace in that. And to some extent, that's his own goddamn fault.
Yeah, there's no real arc to his character or any of the characters. Mm-hmm.
I can understand him feeling sorry for himself that his wife and daughter died not long before he meets Lestat and gets turned into the vampire. Okay, fine, but it's been years. And then decades. And then centuries. And you're still whining? At some point, grow a pair and learn that this is your life and shut the fuck up.
It works in the book because novels just work differently from a narrative perspective, but they really needed to ditch the Paris stuff. Fans of the book probably would have raged out about this, but to make a good film, you just had to keep the story about him and Lestat when they...
Well, Claudia.
Oh, sure, of course Claudia, but I mean the main conflict...
Stay in Louisiana, stay in America.
...is about their conflict with Lestat. Yeah, exactly. Stay in Louisiana, stay in America. That's where the story is. To carry it on after Lestat is dead is
the Hostel
such
movies
mistake.
Taught us don't go to Europe. This movie should have learned from Hostel. Don't go to Europe.
Hostel came out after this.
I know,
so.
But it still shows sign in the future and said, don't go to Europe. To hear us talk about movies we liked, well, not this movie's terrible, but performances we liked by Brad Pitt. We did cover Seven and Fight Club. Well, Fight Club I have issues with too, but his performance is a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah,
and of course, I love Seven. I think you also learned to respect Seven. You did. I remember hearing that podcast again not long ago. This, by the way, represented Kirsten Dunst's first screen kiss. And I guess at 11 years old, that makes sense. But she's kissing Brad Pitt. Maybe she'd like that more now, because apparently at the time, he was smoking cigarettes by the truckload.
Yeah, and he was her father's age, I'm sure.
Hmm. But even beyond that, we both kiss smokers, and it's not the nicest thing in the world. And that's your first kiss, at least on screen. Better debuts for kissing than that. Okay, the movie is 185-1. We watched it on TMN, the Movie Network, on demand. And as I've said before, when movies are free, they've got a better chance of getting reviewed by us. Because this was going to be the
Blair... we're cheap.
This was going to be the Blair Witch Project slot, but we wanted to go with the 74 movie, the 84 movie, the 94 movie, and the 2004 movie. Every 10 years and all with fives, so 45 years, 35 years, and so on from now. The cinematographer, Philippe Rousselot, won an Oscar 2 years before for A River Runs Through It. The editors, Mick Audsley and Jokke van Wyk. I'm guessing I got that right. Spelled joke, but Jokke. Audsley cut 12 Monkeys, which is going to get covered next year, and Van Wyk only cut 3 movies in total. And the composer, who was nominated for an Oscar, Elliot Goldenthal, did a lot with Jordan and won an Oscar for Frida in 2002 and also did the music for Heat, which a lot of people love, including me. What did you think of the camera work, the editing, and the score?
Cinematography is excellent. You didn't mention production design.
Nominated for the sets.
Really excellent. Costumes, makeup, hair, all that stuff. Well, maybe not so much makeup and hair. But anyway, the editing... The first 10 minutes go by way too fast.
Right.
Like they really mishandle the introduction of the story. And then, of course, the last act is a mess. I think they were just sticking too close to the book. Anyway, already complained about that. Editing, not amazing. Boy, do I hate the score. But this is also the type of score that I always hate.
But you gotta cut horror films, and this is effectively a horror film. It better be if we're doing it this month. A little bit more slack.
Oh, and I think the movie is intentionally trying to evoke classic horror. Everything about it is so gothic. And the melodrama, the music, the production design, it's all trying to get the feel of those old Universal horror films. It's just that I hate that kind of score.
I have no problem with the music. I like music in movies more than you do in general anyway. All right, there's a lot of connections. One of them is there was a sequel, Queen of the Damned, with Aaliyah, the pop star, in 2002, which was a semi-dud. Not a big dud, but certainly not successful like this was, effectively. But it was critically savage. This movie didn't have a lot of critics on its side, just barely a fresh tomato. That one wasn't even close to being critically liked.
Of all the books I read, Queen of the Damned was my all-time favorite.
We talked about the comparisons to Dracula, as in the Coppola movie 2 years before, and then Nosferatu, the multiple versions. I think it has connections to both, but really more so Nosferatu. And the original we covered a couple years ago, actually. I think it was 2017 we covered Nosferatu from 1922. And then the other comparison I want to make is to The Favorite, which we saw for the second time very recently. Excellent movie from last year. Would have been a good choice for Best Picture, certainly better than Green Book. Both movies, you've got a threesome, homosexuality, and then jealousy about a lover finding a new love.
Oh, I guess so.
Because when Claudia comes into the picture and she's having fun with Lestat, doing the things they're doing, killing all these people and turning them, well, I guess they don't turn them into vampires because they don't want more company. But Louis gets jealous of that and doesn't like it too much.
Oh, that's right.
And I think Lestat's also a little jealous of Claudia and Louis' relationship, even though Lestat created Claudia. And since Lestat is from, I think it's France, isn't it? At least from the old country, shouldn't it be Lestat?
Oh, sure, maybe.
Maybe we're all pronouncing it wrong, and Anne Rice meant it to be Lestat.
Maybe. There's so many connections when you look at vampires and pop culture from here on out. Anne Rice was kind of the George Romero of vampires and pop culture. And the way that vampires existed before she started writing, just like zombies existed before Night of the Living Dead, but her influence so dramatically transformed their depiction that there's a clear line of before and after her work. Now, the first book, Interview with a Vampire, came out in 1976, but I don't think it really was household name popular until around the time that this movie was getting picked up, or at least I had never heard of it before then, so maybe I'm just speaking of my own experiences.
One name I think she apparently wanted to play Lestat was Rutger Hauer.
Who?
The guy from Blade Runner.
Oh my god, yeah, I could definitely see that. Yeah, yeah. But if the movie had been made in the 70s.
Oh yeah, he's too old for
yeah,
that.
Of course, yeah, yeah, yeah. So before Anne Rice, was there a vampire in popular culture that was sympathetic like Louis is? I think this may be the first example of the poor little vampire trope where they suffer for their nature and their immortality and genuinely try to resist causing harm. You have some vampires in comic books like Blade or Vampirella who are outliers and that they're heroes, but they don't dwell on the angst of their nature like this. And from that, you cannot underestimate the legacy Rice had on the subgenre of vampires in popular culture, where you've got Angel and Buffy, you've got True Blood, which is practically Anne Rice fanfiction, Twilight, which is also practically Anne Rice fanfiction, and instead of equating murder with sex, makes the vampire heroes for practicing abstinence. She was also the first person to depict vampire communities. Dracula has these worshipful servants, but prior to Interview, we never saw vampire families or communities, something that is now completely ubiquitous in all of vampire depictions in pop culture.
If you're going to make this seem realistic-ish, and ish is important there, then yeah, why wouldn't they congregate? Why wouldn't Louis try to find people like him? Although he doesn't really seem to look that hard in the States. Maybe they just skip over that. Finally, the movie gets a little bit of pace. Skip ahead, skip ahead, skip ahead. Go to Paris. And then slow down, and slow down, and slow down. But he does find people like him, at least, or creatures like him.
Well, the template before this was always Dracula, where you just have one powerful vampire that's a loner and a monster. And this changed it forever.
And the movie was successful. It wasn't gigantic hit compared to some other things that Cruise and then Pitt would eventually do, but it did succeed.
Of course, the books were mega hits.
All right, of course.
Yeah.
So what happens next? I think Lestat goes back to that hotel to confront Louis, because we don't see Louis really do anything after he threatens Malloy, who runs away. Those two kiss and make up, and then finally consummate the relationship properly, because vampires gotta fuck. They should be fucking. Why aren't they fucking? I know they don't need to, like they don't need to eat, and they don't need to drink water and booze and everything else, but they should be fucking.
I know what happens next because I read all the books, so it's
We've been covering a lot of movies that have had sequels lately, too, so it's a bad question maybe for Nightmare on Elm Street, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this, and certainly Saw next week. So that's why what happens next doesn't work as well with this. It worked better with Whiplash and some of the films we covered before.
I'll tell you what happens next and what should happen next is that Lestat, who is way cooler than Louis, just finally snaps out of it and moves on with his life.
Yeah. Moving on!
He doesn't really think about Louis much after this in the books. One more theme that I want to talk about before we wrap up is the way that they use vampirism as a metaphor for drug addiction.
I want to give you an addiction!
Well, it's funny you say that, because Lestat is kind of like his dealer. He's the devil on his shoulder. He encourages him to give in to his cravings, regardless of the consequences. He says to Claudia, I'm going to give you what you need to get well.
This one's free.
It reminds me of how an addict requests for drugs. I'm sick, man. I just need drugs. He's an unscrupulous dealer who creates customers by tempting them with his product. When he first turns Louis, they have the scene where he's seeing the world for the first time with vampire eyes, and he's hallucinating as if he just did drugs. Then, of course, he tries to go clean and resist taking human life, even though it's the only thing that would sate his hunger and end his suffering.
Rats.
Very much like a druggy, but, okay, well, I can't shoot heroin, so I'm gonna do yoga, or I'm gonna smoke cigarettes all day and night and drink coffee
just
and go to meetings every single day, and you have to do all these things to cope with the fact that you will never really be free from this addiction.
Tandy Newton is in this movie. You mentioned her earlier. She's Yvette, the servant girl who just gives herself up to Pitt in his new addiction. And she and Cruise were in Mission Impossible 2 together quite a few years later. I'm not a big fan of that movie either, so I guess I prefer this one to that one. But anyway, just that little aside that Tanya Newton went on to do big things. She's the best thing in Crash, which you didn't like. A lot of people didn't like. The Oscar it's a winner.
Bad movie, so.
Not very good in Westworld, despite her Emmy nominations and Golden Globe
nominations. Oh, I like her in Westworld.
I don't love her in that TV show. But her tiny role in this is pretty effective. And maybe that does play into your addiction theme, too, because he obviously likes Yvette. Maybe even has a certain amount of love for her, because he's portrayed as a nice slave owner. And maybe she loves him back, or at least likes him back. She's saying, go ahead, if you need to, so badly, Mr. Addicted Slave Guy, then go ahead and take what you need from me, too.
I doubt there were that many slaves back then.
Right. And when I first saw this movie, I didn't pick up on the slave owner thing. He says plantation, but that didn't mean anything to me when I saw this movie 20-some-odd years ago. I've seen this movie 3 times. I've still never liked it all that much. Just like I said when Chris and I covered Slapshot recently, 3 viewings, still not a big fan, not saying they're terrible. A lot of things to like in both of them. This more so, I would say, because of the production design, and it is fun a lot of the time with Cruise. But Pitt's character, maybe not even Pitt himself, although he didn't want to do it, but his character doesn't help. So I'm a mild thumbs down. It's okay, but I'm never going to see it again. How about you?
If it was on TV, I might just let it play out.
Yeah, you're the one that said when the movie was over that you thought it was a bad movie.
It's a bad movie. It's a watchable bad movie.
Okay, fair.
Maybe part of it is that all of the notes it hits are things that appeal to women. All the vampire stuff, it just scratches an itch that seems to be particularly important for women.
But I'm the one saying there's not enough romance in it. There should be more romancing going on.
It's all about romance. Yeah, the whole romance. Thing is about a relationship, a romantic relationship between Louis and Lestat.
Kind of fails at that level.
It is kindred with the slasher films that we've covered this month. They're more popular than they are great.
This also isn't scary at all, although we have never covered before. I don't think we ever have a vampire movie, so that's one reason we picked it, and because it was free. Anyway, could be worse, could be better. Interview of the Vampire ends now. So in 7 days, we'll skip ahead another 10 years to 2004 and lock ourselves in a dirty bathroom as we highlight our last entry in Scary Movie Month, the week of Halloween, in fact, Saw. We did Texas Chainsaw Massacre earlier this month. Well, technically last month, but part of Scary Movie Month because it was only one day before. And now we're doing the first of what they call the torture porn movies, Saw. But as we'll learn next week, not that torture porny. The sequels, yes, very gory. This one, not as much. All right, so the coming attractions opinion. I had a hell of a time thinking of something good for this movie, so I came up with this because we've talked about this month already. Totally an opinion, and I'm going to give you 10 options. Who is the greatest horror movie director of all time?
Oh.
You've got another 50 or 60 you can name, but here are the 10 I thought should be ranked somewhere in there. Maybe we'll both do a top 5, I don't know. George Romero, Dario Argento, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, James Whale, Sam Raimi, Guillermo del Toro, David Cronenberg, I think I'm going to pronounce this right. Takashi Miike, the guy who did Audition, I believe it is. Or James Wan, who directed Saw. You could mention someone like Kubrick, who did The Shining. Jennifer Kent did The Babadook. Jordan Peele now doing his horror films. But I wanted to go with people who've done more than, in those cases, like one or two. A lot of these people have done a lot of horror
you
films.
You want who's the objectively best horror director or who's my favorite?
Either. But I'm just saying that all those names directed multiples and more than just two. Ari Aster's another one. Ari Aster, Jordan Peele, another 5 years now. They maybe would top this list. But for now, they've only done 2 horror films apiece. So I'm talking about people who have done a lot of them.
All right. So for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Saw. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com, for more from us. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. In exchange for all of this amazing content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
We may not cover this movie this year. We probably won't. Bowfinger, it connects to the Interview of the Vampire. I had to set up this way by saying, I love the line in that movie where Steve Martin says, because they're going to fake that they're going to shoot a movie with Eddie Murphy, who's supposed to be a big star, which he was in reality, but the character. Tom Cruise didn't even know he's in that vampire movie, which is hilarious when you think about the fact that Tom Cruise probably doesn't act anything like this. As much as he might be weird behind the scenes,
full costume.
He's not weird like this. I don't think. Or is he?
maybe it's a Scientology thing to wear ponytails and very light makeup.
Murder people and turn them into your buddy who lives with you forever. Just choose wisely next time, Tom Cruise.
And cut.